session number 30108, Reel 2.
John, there's Reel 2. Could you explain the term gopher wallers for me?
A gopher waller was a man who sold sundries to the troops in Northern Ireland, and possibly elsewhere, wherever British forces served, but in Northern Ireland, in each camp, there were generally two men from the Asian subcontinent, or Indian subcontinent. They would live in the camp, sleep in their shop, and they sold toothpaste and shaving sticks, etc., because we couldn't leave the camp to go and buy these things. I think one was killed, but they came and went, and I guess went to the warehouse and stocked up with their supplies, and they sold hamburgers as well and things like that. But
can you describe the camp to me? This obviously because it was defended, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was almost Victorian style brick building on about three or four floors, an old police barracks, courtyard in the middle. And we came under fire so often, I remember a delivery of sheet metal coming, and huge bulletproof metal, or whatever it was called, armour plating. And of course we had to carry them up the winding staircases so that they could be bolted against the windows. Yeah.
And within that environment, were you allowed out of the...
Never. Never. Only on patrol, and... So you wore a uniform all the time. When you weren't on patrol, you were mostly on standby. And I can remember naively keeping my boots on for a week. And I'm sure the old sweats were sliding out of their boots when we should have had them on. Just to give. And of course, I was almost fresh out of the box training. I only did what I was told. And kept my boots on for a week. And took them off, peeled my socks off at the end of that week. And I thought... my feet reminded me of two pieces of haddock in the fishmongers, you know, and I almost got trench foot without getting my feet wet, I think.
What facilities were in the camp for ablutions or washing clothes? Was there anything available for you there?
No, sinks, if I recall. And, of course, it was also in the days before there were any civilian contractors to come in and help, so you could come in from patrol and find yourself in the grease pit for 2 hours, and you'd be scrubbing the pots and pans that the chefs had used to cook the evening meal. So you had to carry out all those administrative functions yourself. It was relatively early days of Northern Ireland, I suppose, before that civilian infrastructure grew, and life became a little bit easier then when you didn't have these other duties to perform.
And what was the duration of a tour in?
4 months, with a 5-day R&R package at some point, round about the halfway.
And where would that be? Would that be within Northern Ireland or could you come
no,
back
no.
to the mainland?
You came back to the mainland, went home or went to see a girlfriend or whatever. So it was a day's travelling each way, which allowed you 3 days at home.
The end of your first tour in 72, where did you go to? Did you come back to the mainland at that point?
Yes, we came back to Plymouth. We were on leave then within a week. I think we had 3 weeks leave, which took us almost up to Christmas leave itself. So I think we had a couple of weeks leave, probably, back to camp for a few weeks, Christmas leave, and then we deployed to the Caribbean January to March. And we were back in Northern Ireland by June, so life was fairly hectic.
Had it allowed you that, as you said, though, you went into the middle of a kind of tour when you arrived, did that allow you to bond a lot more quickly with your comrades rather than...
Absolutely. I mean, I can remember arriving in Brown Square, and they said, the Sergeant Major said, the troop you're joining is currently guarding the Crumlin Road jail. So we were taken up to the Crumlin Road, the four of us who joined A Troop in a pig, a Humber one-ton armoured vehicle, and shown a mattress to lay on, and immediately put into the watch roster. And 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, I was on the front sanger in the Crumlin Road jail with a guy of Maltese extraction, Frank Belize, and recruit glaze was marine glaze fresh out of the box.
Did the older members of the troop, were they able to impart information to you about the environment that you were in?
Yes, they imparted more stories about, in their words, the Ulu, the jungle, because the majority had served a 40 commando in the Far East, based in Singapore, so they were old jungle sweats, and they didn't like the urban environment much at all. You know, for me, it was almost easier for me to integrate into street patrol in the NEM, because, you know, they had this legacy of jungle patrolling and life in the Far East, in Singapore.
And how much of a sort of handover would you get from the unit that was there before you? Would there be anything of that nature, that would be information that would be passed down to you, to the level that you were out there as a Marine at that stage?
In 73, because when I was in an INT section, we went out earlier to pick up this in-depth knowledge of an area, and then when the company came, there was a couple of days handover with the outgoing company, but we, in the INT section, and other key players within a company, would have spent a week or longer with the outgoing company, and then it was up to us then to meet our company and impart any knowledge that we'd managed to pick up.
And that would that be for the kind of local players and what was going on, and if things had changed in a certain area, or if people had moved location?
Absolutely, exactly that.
Well, your role within the intelligence section, would you still be involved in patrolling in 73, or were you involved in other activities?
Patrolling, observation posts, photography, long range photography. So we often patrolled, well, in section, we had two in sections actually in Charlie Company. There were four in each, if I remember. Maybe five, a sergeant, a corporal, and three Marines. So, yeah, we patrolled, we hung around clubs and pubs and tried to get an idea or a feel for what was going on.
When you did that, would you be in civilian clothing?
Oh, no. No.
That would still be as military?
Yes, yeah. And, I mean, we would go in a UDA club, and although we were aware that although we were being treated as friends, there was also a possibility that we were being used. So the handshakes and the smiles may have hidden an ulterior motive. And, that did not go unnoticed by us, really.
Would that be the case of the UDA trying to impart information to you?
No.
Would it never be?
No, because they had their own agenda, I think. And by being friendly with us, I suppose they thought they could pursue that without too much interference.
Would you glean much information from, say, a UDA club?
Not really. No. No. They said as much as they wanted to do, and it was mainly bonhomie and nothing in depth at all. They didn't want to talk politics or local issues. They would direct a lot of their conversation towards their opposition, and they maybe want to talk about the next street across, which was Republican Street. They didn't want to talk about what they were up to at all.
And with the Republicans, was there any level of contact with any members of the society? Would any of the Republican people in the Republican be friendly, or would that be seen as a...
No, I think even those, I accept that the majority of them were law-abiding citizens who just wanted a peaceful life, but I don't think it would have been wise for them to show any degree of friendship or a polite nod in the morning to us. It just would not have... boded well for them. I can remember an occasion where when one of the patrols knocked a dog down, and there were lots of dogs roaming around the streets, and one of the patrols, mobile patrols, killed a dog, and it was decided that we would replace the dog. And so the INT section was dispatched to the local dog's home, and in a hearts and minds capacity, turn up and say, sorry we killed your dog, here's a new dog. Well, they didn't want it. They wouldn't accept it. I can remember an occasion where we put up football posts for the kids, goal posts, on a piece of waste ground so they could go and kick a ball. And we thought that would be more useful than throwing stones at us, but overnight the posts were burnt down. No, the hand of friendship was not gratefully received.
Had the situation changed between 72 and 73?
No. Almost exactly the same. The same main players were on the boards. A younger element had come through because the attrition rate was quite high. When I say the main players, some had been killed or captured. And youngsters who we just knew as stone-throwing yobs in 72 were suddenly local dons in 73. And promotion was quite fast in the IRA, but careers could be shortened equally as quickly.
Would you be involved in an arrest situation at all?
Yeah, and again, that was normally planned to the nth degree and was executed very, very quickly. And there would be some form of cordon go out, the arrest teams would go in, grab those individuals, get them out of the environment as quickly as possible, and the cordon would withdraw.
And would you also be involved in search operations?
Early morning, regularly, again cordons, inner and outer cordons, and the search teams. And it just seems so bizarre now to go to someone's house at 3 o'clock in the morning, kick the door in, and then go and rifle through their possessions. That was a regular occurrence in those days.
Would many items be found on these search operations?
Sometimes, a rare find of some ammunition or a weapon. Often, other items which could rouse our suspicion, like timing mechanisms, or we found a series of clocks once, and we thought, well, maybe this is part of bomb-maker material. And I think it later transpired that the guy was a pigeon racer, and these were the clocks he used to time the pigeons and how long it took to get back to his loft, And we were always looking for false panels or whatever, because they weren't going to just shove it under the bed. There would have been something, some 4x2 put up and papered over or something. So guys involved in these searches would have been away on a search techniques course and spent a lot of time tapping walls or looking for loose floorboards, etc., etc.
And what was the demeanour of the people when you were making a search? What would they be like normally?
Not happy at all. They would all be put into one room. We would have a female with us for the women and children there. And so if a search was happening, we'd all muster at 2 o'clock in the morning or something, and other agencies would come, because obviously Royal Marines is an all-male body. So the females would come. I think they had a radio titled Green Finch. And off we went to the search. The occupants all put in a room. And difficult, really, because kids were crying and upset. Mothers were shouting and swearing. People out in the street, if they became aware, would be spitting on the cordon. I can remember a friend of mine who'd been outside a house which we were searching. And we were in there about an hour, I suppose. And when we got outside, his jacket was almost soaking wet, as if he'd been in the rain, and it was spit. He was just totally, utterly distraught.
As I say, because that sounds to me like one of the most difficult jobs that you have to be engaged in, because you're actually dealing a lot of the time, aren't we, with civilians in that situation where they speak the same language, in a sense,
yes,
as well. And it could be in a house that looks like a house in a normal town. Did that play on people's minds at all?
I don't think so, because within our own company, there were Ulstermen. There might have been the odd Irishman from south of the border. They saw themselves first and foremost as Marines doing a job, and followed the diktats from above. You go on a search, I'll do the search. You go on a cordon, I'll do the cordon. I don't think we actually had any inner soul search. And my goodness, these are white people who speak English, and this is the British Isles. No, it didn't actually permeate down to our level of consciousness, I don't think.
If you were entering an area like that, would there, in, say, a Republican area where you're going to make a search, would there be a system, sort of a bush telegraph that allowed people to know that you were in the
area? Oh, yes. And, I mean, if an IRA man was on the move, he'd have his outriders, pedestrian, and he'd be in... often, when we were in OPs, and you'd be looking right down... all the streets ran parallel, you know, very much back-to-back house environment. What became known as the dickers were out first, and these were the people who came and stood on the street corner to try and find out where the patrols were. Are there any patrols in the area? So the dickers would be constantly on watch. And in fact, not just when the IRA man wanted to move from A to B, dickers were out trying to ascertain how regular patrols were taking place. Was there a fixed pattern? Was there a certain time of day when a patrol was always at its most vulnerable? Could they mount an operation against that patrol on those occasions? Did one patrol have more Welsh guys in it than another? And there was one patrol which was all nearly, by coincidence, all Scottish blokes. And they very quickly became aware of that, because they felt Scottish patrols were harder on them because of this Orangeman link, and probably more venom was directed towards the jocks than I think there were a couple of taffs in my patrol as well. But they had a very good intelligence network based upon eyes on the street and local knowledge of their area. They knew every back alley, every shortcut. The houses themselves were often mouse-holed, so a gunman could take a shot from one derelict building, and then because they were terrorists, he could mouse-hole down through and hop over a few garden fences, give someone a weapon who takes it off somebody else somewhere else, and emerge 10 doors down the street maybe.
And if they were mounting an operation to attack a patrol like that, would it usually be a group of people that would bring the weapon, the ammunition, together?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it might have been a woman with a pram pushing a baby. The shooter, as far as I'm aware, just went to the place, picked up the weapon, carried it out, left the weapon, and was away.
Would that make it more difficult, obviously, for you to locate anybody who would do that?
Yeah, because the most dangerous people weren't walking around the street with shoulder holsters or, in those days, a Thompson rather than an Uzi underneath his overcoat.
When you'd gone in 72, had Mortimer taken place, or were there still no-go areas?
Mortimer happened while we were out there. 4-5 Commando came out to reinforce us specifically for Mortimer.
And at that stage, prior to Mortimer, was the areas that you wouldn't enter?
No, we didn't have any no-go areas in 40 Commando's area of responsibility. Now, Londonderry may have been a different kettle of fish, but down in Belfast, if we wanted to go in an area, we went in an area, and nothing was sacrosanct in that way.
You mentioned women might help, obviously, with that. Mm. To what degree were women involved in Republican activities?
Well, I'm trawling back through my memory. Banks, I believe they were known as the Cumann na Bean. That was the Gaelic for the women's section of the Irish Republican Army. And they were an integral part of that. They had a full part to play. As what the youth section, if I recall, was the Fianna Fáil. And it was like, I suppose, having cadets or junior leaders coming through into the army. And when the Protestants themselves, when they marched down the Shankill Road, they informed bodies wearing uniforms. There may be 40 women then, lying abreast, pardon the pun, wearing red crosses, because they would be the medical division of the Protestant army, if you wish. Very organised.
As a young Marine, was it sometimes a difficult situation to comprehend, the Northern Ireland situation?
Well, I thought it was so crazy that these passions could be aroused. And they could be mostly aroused in, we'll say, depressed areas. If you were to move out into the hinterland of Belfast, into middle-class suburbia, this type of thing didn't exist. You know, there were just people living in semi-detached houses, mowing their lawns, scared to go into the city centre. Because all those old Victorian terraced areas, be they Protestant or Catholic, they really generated the fervour, whether that fervour was nationalist or rule Britannia.
The other question I have is about explosive devices. What was the threat of explosive devices like?
We weren't really aware of explosive devices directed specifically at us as targets in 1972. There was much more a campaign of bombing out the city centre. So they were big devices taken into a shop or whatever. Often a warning. In fact, the bus, I think we were there on what became known as Bloody Friday, where Belfast city centre was bombed out completely, and most of those bombs were in our patch. And it seemed that each explosion was getting closer to Brown Square, so it was decided that we would all go out on patrol, and only the cooks were left manning the sentry positions, because we thought it was safer on the street than in this place, because it all seemed to be getting too close for comfort.
Were there any significant differences between 72 and 73 that you noticed? Because obviously...
Well, I was a little bit older and wiser then, I suppose. Not a huge amount of difference. We were generally doing... I'd moved from the city centre up into the New Lodge area, because it was a good idea, actually, to put Charlie Company had done a job in one area. Same unit area the next year, put Charlie Company in a different area. But generally we went out about our business in the same way as a company group. My job was slightly different because I was no longer a rifleman in a patrol, I was a rifleman in an int section. So it was the same atmosphere within the city then, I would say, as opposed to in the 80s, when I went back in the 80s, or on flying tours at the end of the 70s.
What was the New Lodge area like?
That was very much as you would envisage Coronation Street. All parallel streets, back-to-back houses.
Was it a mixed area?
No, no. And mixed areas, I think, even by then, were becoming fewer and far between, because if a Protestant lived in a street and there were, we'll say, even if there were 10% Protestants in a street and 90% Catholics, they would have to move out. And I think we looked at what were called tribal maps over a couple of years apart, and they were marked out in green and orange, and you could actually see horns of green coming around an orange area, and then eventually that green area would move one way, but the orange area of course would have to compensate in another direction because of that, and so that sectarianism became more firmly entrenched, I think, from the end of the 60s through into the mid 70s.
And what was the affiliation in the New Lodge area?
Oh, that was Republican, yeah. And then across the road at Dunkern Gardens, and I can't recall the area's name, that was hard Protestant. So that's where we based our Zulu muster I mentioned earlier, from which we patrolled into the Republican areas.
Were you there at all during the marching season?
The Protestant marching season, yep. And that's when July the 12th, of course, big day, Battle of the Boyne, and that's when they came down the Shankill, really. But, you know, there was a build-up to that. The marching season, as you say, sort of kicked off fairly low-key, I suppose, and then the Battle of the Boyne was celebrated. And out came the lambeg drum and the pipes and the whistles. And of course, if they were passing a Catholic area, then they beat that lambeg drum louder and louder. And of course, we used to have four tunners with great Hessian screens alongside to try and keep the two bodies apart, because they were just winding each other up.
Would that always be successful, or were there points, flash points that you would have? Say,
flash point, Unity Corner was a big flash point. And, you know, they built this block of flats, Unity Flats, and it was supposed to be a mixed community in there. Never happened. Whether Protestants had ever lived in, I don't know, but Unity Flats was hardcore Republican, and that was a major flashpoint, because they'd come down the Shankill, and then as soon as they got a beam Unity Flats, and certainly on the corner, right at the edge of the city centre, that's where we often set up the four tunners and the screens, and because we knew it was going to happen there, the lambeg drum would beat, and a few stones would come out of the flats. And
was it difficult, obviously, having such a high rised building around you as well, because I assume that that would be...
Well, they weren't high rise in the same way as Rossville Flats in the New Lodge. These were like four stories, I suppose. Firing points from anywhere. I mean, you couldn't possibly cover all the firing points. But I think we enjoyed it as young Marines. And if there was a special patrol group within the Royal Ulster Constabulary, used to call for a couple of Marines to go with them, and there was never a shortage of volunteers. And guys in my troop used to consistently put their hand up for special patrol group because they knew there was going to be some action. And it was better than being stuck in barracks buying burgers from the Gofferwaller, I suppose. They wanted to be out on the ground enjoying themselves.
What would a special patrol group be doing?
Oh, they would just target these hard areas, really. But they had to maintain a police presence. It was almost total breakdown of law and order. And but the police needed a bit of firepower with them. So to assist them to achieve a profile within a community, we sent a couple of guys out. And of course, the police themselves had a good intelligence network, and they'd grown up in the city. They knew who the real bad ones were, and we had no-go areas. Most areas, the police couldn't go into at all.
What were relations like with the police?
Very good, actually. I mean, but then again, they saw us as their private army, perhaps, almost, because I guess some of those were dyed-in-the-wool Protestants. And, you know, I can't fault their loyalty to Queen and country. But it was at the expense of another part of the community. And, you know, if you read the history of Ireland, I mean, yeah.
Again, was it another strange and part of the complex nature of the situation, I mean, was it?
Because the Irish are good at history, you see, and they'll tell us what Oliver Cromwell did to them, and if you read it and listen to them, then there's a great deal of logic in why they think the way they do. But I don't know, it's a strange situation, isn't it, where there's an island and a bit of it is Ireland, but the other bit is United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It's a dichotomy.
So in 73, you finish your tour in 73, what was the next move?
Okay, leave, Christmas, series of exercises and training. Then we went on standby early 74, and the Cyprus situation blew up.